Welcome to Eastern Standard, produced for WEKU by Dynamics Productions. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for joining us. This week, Crystal Wilkinson and Frank X. Walker on being named to the Kentucky Writers Hall of Fame. How the art of Lexington sculptor John Tuska is finding its way into the classroom. And in keeping with this year of exploring our history, inspired by Lexington celebrating its 250th anniversary, a conversation with the creator of a podcast series about the controversial Civil War statue that stands in front of the Jessamine County Courthouse in Nicholasville. We begin with another piece of local history. As famed commentator Paul Harvey used to say,
"Now, the rest of the story."
The story of the Choctaw Academy, that is, the first federally controlled residential boarding school for Native Americans in U.S. history. It opened in 1825 as a school for young boys from the Choctaw Nation. What remains of the school sits on a Scott County farm now owned by Georgetown ophthalmologist Chip Richardson, who has a deep passion for American history. As WEKU's Sam Dick has reported, Dr. Richardson has been working to preserve what remains of the school, an old stone building that was once a dormitory at Choctaw Academy. But as we hear in this Carolyn DuPont interview, there is more to the story of life on that farm where the academy was located. Much more.
We're speaking today with Dr. Amrita Chakrabarty Myers, author of The Vice President's Black Wife. And welcome to the program, Dr. Myers.
Thank you so much for having me, Carolyn. I'm really pleased to be here.
So you've written a book about Julia Chin. Explain to our audience who she was.
So Julia Chin was an enslaved woman born in Kentucky at some point in the 1790s. And she and her mother and her brother were owned by Robert and Jemima Suggett Johnson, some of the original Virginians who came and settled the territory of Kentucky. And when Julia was about 13 years old, Robert and Jemima transferred her along with her brother Daniel to one of their sons, Richard Mentor Johnson. Richard was a politician. He spent at least half of the year in Washington, D.C. each year. He started out as a state legislator for the State House in Kentucky and then became a senator and a congressman and eventually vice president of the United States. And so Julia and Daniel were taken away from Johnson Station, where the senior Johnsons lived, and they were transferred over to Blue Spring Farm, which was Richard's home. It was about 2 miles away from where they had grown up at Johnson Station, and this meant being separated from their mother. And within a year of arriving at Blue Spring Farm, Julia not only became the housekeeper, right, the manager of Blue Spring and all of its household staff and many tasks, she also became involved in a sexual relationship with Richard Mentor Johnson, which would last for almost a quarter century, and the couple would go on to have 2 daughters together. And so this is a book about Julia, about her daughters, about what it meant to be enslaved Black women in rural Kentucky in the late 1700s, early into mid 1800s. What did their lives look like? How much privilege and power did they have because of their connection to Johnson? And where were those lines of privilege sharply drawn? You know, where were the spaces they could not enter into? That's a brief introduction to Julia.
One of the things that your book makes clear is that it's difficult to know very much about Julia Chin. It's difficult to research her. And can you explain to our listeners why it's so difficult to find information about Julia Chin?
No, absolutely. I thought at first that it would be very easy because since Chin was involved with a very powerful white man who was a lawyer, a politician, an enslaver, a large landholder, a member of one of the first families of Kentucky, that there should be lots of records. There should be lots of materials on Johnson, and that through Johnson, I would be able to find materials on her and their daughters. And I was surprised to discover that there wasn't a large vice presidential Richard Mentor Johnson library. There are not large repositories of papers in Washington, D.C. or in Kentucky. that really shocked me. Mm-hmm. And it made my research much more difficult because instead of the plantation records, business logs, journals, diaries, letters that I anticipated having access to, I had to really piece together Julia's life from a variety of sources scattered around the country. I had to find Richard's letters written to other people, which were housed in their collections. For example, the Thomas Henderson papers, which are housed at the Filson Historical Society in Louisville. Just one example. There was a small amount of business correspondence at the Library of Congress, mainly Richard talking to bankers, lawyers, and creditors about his financial woes. But I also had to turn really directly to public records, government-produced documents. So this meant things like, or state-produced documents. This meant things like newspapers, which were really important, both local, state, and national newspapers. This meant church records, parish registers for Great Crossing Baptist Church, which was a church founded by several people from Virginia, including the senior Johnsons, Richard's parents, and the church that Richard and Julia attended with their daughters. So he attended that church growing up, and so did Julia, because the enslaved laborers from Johnson Station were taken to that church for services. The Choctaw Academy papers, which were government records about an indigenous boarding school housed on Blue Spring Farm, those materials became critically important. And then letters from in the Thomas Henderson collection, which I had just mentioned, which contained letters that Richard wrote to Thomas Henderson, who was the headmaster of Choctaw Academy. So I had to really go about it in a very different way, looking at wills, estate records, census materials, tax documents, in order to recreate Julia's life in rural Kentucky, because all the letters that she and her daughters wrote to Richard disappeared. And I'm fairly certain that given that all of his records have disappeared into the ether, that there was a deliberate attempt to destroy them in order to erase the fact that Julia and her daughters even existed. And so it made my life much more difficult, but you can't destroy all the public records. And so it just meant a longer road to getting this book out.
It's the same problem that we have in researching the lives of the enslaved generally, is that so often they're not allowed to speak in their own words, and we have to look at the words of others to find things out. But what I hear you saying is that there's even an extra layer here in which the record has erased her. So not just the usual erasure of an enslaved woman, but a purposeful erasure, perhaps by Johnson family members.
That's exactly correct. You're absolutely right. Indigenous folks, stories of early women, particularly enslaved and free Black women, are hard to come to. I actually refer to myself as a historical private detective.
Yeah.
because I really have to go hunting for the materials. In this case, it was doubly depressing because Julia and her daughters were literate. They knew how to read and write. They did write letters to Richard. And Richard references those letters in his own mm-hmm. letters to other people. And so we know that they were writing to him. And so that's really sort of the knife in the heart that I still can't quite get over, is that these materials were deliberately destroyed because Richard's brothers, who inherited what was left of his estate upon his death, they went to court. They said that to probate court, they said that he had died without a will, and that he had no descendants living other than themselves, which was a lie, because he had daughters and grandchildren living right in the area. But the probate judge, of course, agreed, gave everything that was left to these two brothers. And I'm fairly certain that one of the things that they did was destroy all of their brothers' papers because they were embarrassed by the life that he led. And they didn't want to acknowledge Julia and her daughters and grandchildren, because that would have also meant that they were not entitled to the estate, in large part. And so they literally tried to erase their very existence from the face of the earth.
I do want to ask more about that. But before we get to that, I wanted to ask you to talk more about something that you referred to just a few minutes ago. And that's the fact that Julia Chin was able to escape the worst aspects of slavery because of her proximity to Richard. But there are other ways that race was always the defining factor for her. So can you explain that complicated and contradictory aspect of her life?
Well, I think that it's easy to look at Julia and think that she had a very privileged life because Richard didn't have a white wife. He never married a white woman. He didn't have white children, right, according to Kentucky law. And he also chose not to hide his relationship with Chin and their daughters. They lived together. Julia was in charge of the plantation when Richard was away. She dealt with temporary white laborers. She dealt with the enslaved workforce on the plantation, both the field hands and the house staff. She had access to lines of credit. She could buy and sell necessary goods for the plantation. So she would do business with local craftsmen and business folks. She and her daughters attended Great Crossing Baptist Church, as I mentioned earlier. So all of these things really seem to imply like quite a level of privilege. But in many other ways, she's exactly like other enslaved women of her era. She's taken away from her mother at the age of 5 in order to be trained as a house servant by Jemima Johnson. And so she no longer lives in the quarters with her mother and her brother. She lives in the main house, and she only sees her families on the occasional Sunday or holidays if work permitted it. So from the age of 5, she's doing hard labor. She's learning how to sew, how to cook, how to weave, how to clean, how to do laundry, taking care of children, all of the. And so from sunup to sundown, she's going to be working because it's, you know, this is frontier Kentucky. There are not the conveniences that we have today to cook and clean and do laundry and things of this nature. And then, of course, at the age of around 13, she's removed from Johnson Station altogether and sent away to Blue Spring Farm, again, like very similar to other enslaved children who are not only removed from their parents to do labor from a young age, but then sold away or gifted away, to family members who they may or may not ever see again. It's possible that Julia and Daniel, who was transferred with her, her brother, did still see their mother occasionally at church on Sundays, but they no longer had immediate or easy access to her. And then again, like many other enslaved women, Julia was in a coercive sexual relationship with her owner. And when I say coercive, slavery always is an institution of coercion. And so that's always present. And yes, she chose to comply, right? Her choices were limited. Her options were few and nothing was very good. And so she had to make a decision. I could run away, but I'll most likely be recaptured, which happened to other people on the Blue Spring plantation. I could be sold away from my children. I could be killed. And so she had to make a decision. Do I resist and potentially face all of these terrible consequences? Or do I comply? I don't call it consent because I don't think consent is possible within the confines of a coercive system like slavery. But she chose to comply, and that compliance ended up actually working out better for her daughters and her grandchildren than for her. She dies enslaved, right? She dies without ever being acknowledged as a legal wife. She's not formally educated. She never owns property, but her daughters gain all of that she never acquires for herself because of her hard work and her sacrifice. Her daughters are free women. They're formally educated. They become property owners. They have, you know, basically what are conceived, you know, considered to be legal marriages to white men in the neighborhood. And so all of the things that she never acquires for herself, Julia is able to acquire for her children.
One of the things I thought was the most interesting among the arguments that you make is, of course, the vast majority of Kentuckians don't know anything about Julia Chin or her common law husband, Richard Minter Johnson. Most Kentuckians know something about Henry Clay, but in many ways, the two men have a, you could say, roughly equal political stature. I mean, they both serve as congressmen. They both serve in the Senate. Johnson actually goes on to become vice president, admittedly to a very unpopular president who does not get reelected. But you argue that in some ways, the fact that most Kentuckians or most Americans don't know anything about Richard Minter Johnson, but they do know about Henry Clay, owes in large part to this open relationship that he has with Julia Chin. And so could you explain that?
Absolutely. I think that, you know, there were many white men in the South in the 18th and 19th centuries who had sexual relationships. with enslaved women. The difference here is that Johnson and Julia's relationship is very open. It's very public. They live in the same home. They raise their two daughters together. Julia is hostess of major parties. They entertain former presidents. They entertain visiting international celebrities like the Marquis de Lafayette. Everyone knows that Julia is the mistress of the plantation, just like a white wife would be considered. She's in charge. There's no hiding her or their daughters. The Marquis meets the Johnson women when he comes to visit. The two girls play piano for the Marquis at that big party that's hosted. And I think that this is absolutely why the very public nature of it is the problem. The problem is not that Richard is having a sexual relationship with a black woman. Henry Clay did the same thing. But Henry Clay had a white wife. He had white children, and he hid his sexual relationships with black women in the quarters. And it's only when his wife catches him with one of those women that, to keep the peace, Clay sells that woman and their biracial children downriver to Louisiana. Johnson is the opposite. Unlike Thomas Jefferson, who never acknowledges his relationship with Sally Hemings, Johnson and Julia's relationship is out in the public, and that's the problem. It's uncomfortable. It makes people, you know, kind of, with, you know, you read the newspaper articles, they're horrified. And in fact, one newspaper editor says the voters could have forgiven Johnson anything if only he had been discreet. And so it's this problem, right, about if he had kept his private life private, nobody would have cared. But he chose to take his private life across the racial divide into the public sphere, and people had to accept it or at least acknowledge it. And this is what made people rebel. And so I think not only do his brothers destroy his papers, there's a conscious effort to forget Richard Johnson and thereby also forget Julia, Imogene, and Adeline, because nobody wanted to have to acknowledge or accept them in the first place. And so that's why I think there's been a national level of forgetting, because Clay doesn't make us uncomfortable, right? Jefferson doesn't make us uncomfortable, because even though they had these black, you know, mistresses or wives, they don't acknowledge them or their children. It's the fact that Johnson does that people go out of their way to forget a vice president of the United States.
Well, in a sense, it's as if Clay and Jefferson, you know, they kept these women in their place as exploitable commodities, where Johnson, in some ways, you know, elevates her by openly acknowledging her. And I think your argument that this is what makes people so uncomfortable really rings true. I wish we had time for more. It's a fascinating book. I hope our listeners will go out and buy The Vice President's Black Wife. And thank you so much for talking with us, Dr. Myers.
It was really a pleasure, Carolyn. Thanks for having me on.
A bronze statue of a Civil War soldier stands outside of the courthouse in Nicholasville. Jessamine County's 1896 memorial to its Confederate dead clutches a rifle, his left foot thrust forward, his eyes stare defiantly past the courthouse yard to the north. But if you look closely, there's something odd about this soldier with a Confederate belt buckle. He's also wearing a Union hat. And that he is not what he seems is the puzzle that comes together in a 7-episode podcast series, Rebel on Main. The work of our guest, David Swartz, a professor of history at Asbury University and resident of Jessamine County, Kentucky. Welcome to Eastern Standard, David.
Thanks, Tom. Great to be with you.
And if you could quickly just give us your background as a historian.
Yeah, I'm actually not a Civil War historian. I was trained at the University of Notre Dame as a historian of American religion. So my first book was about the evangelical left, these theologically evangelical Christians who were politically moderate and progressive. So I asked questions like, how did evangelicals go from voting for Jimmy Carter in 1976 to Donald Trump in 2016? And then I began researching what American evangelicals were doing abroad, specifically to combat human trafficking in Southeast Asia. But the pandemic in 2020 really switched things up for me and you know, turned my attention in a really local direction. I became absolutely fascinated by the Civil War here in Jessamine County. partly because it felt like ghosts and apparitions were appearing all around me all the time. I learned that there were old slave cabins across the street from the middle school that my kids attended. And then a friend of mine found graves of enslaved people on her property down by the Kentucky River. And then, of course, this Confederate statue on our courthouse lawn and Camp Nelson, a former Union Supply Depot and Emancipation Center. I'm originally from north of the Mason-Dixon line in Ohio, and it all felt very, you know, exotic to me. So I set out to do some research on Civil War memory in this county where I live.
What narrowed the subject for you? What motivated you to pursue this particular issue around the statue?
You know, I mean, it was partly these dueling monuments that that emerged. When I got to Kentucky, I began walking by it on the way to pay my vehicle registration fees. I drove by it on the way to my kids' orchestra practice at East Jessamine Middle School. And I was struck by this statue and Camp Nelson especially. Jessamine County was a divided county and a divided state and a divided country, and it just perfectly fit Kentucky's position in the Civil War as this Union state that was also pro-slavery. It was like the epitome of a border state.
There were some protests around this statue, around the possibility of its removal some years ago. I think it was back in around 2020. Did that play into drawing your attention to this as a focus of a story?
Absolutely. The idea for this was just a germ at that point. But then I found myself at those protests watching, and it was quite a juxtaposition to see those protests happening right in front of the statue itself. And so as I stood there, I mean, just all kinds of questions occurred to me. Like, what is Jessamine County, Kentucky doing still maintaining a Confederate statue 150 years after the Civil War? After all, that soldier was in rebellion, right? And was fighting at least to some degree to maintain slavery. And now we find ourselves like 50 years after the Civil Rights Movement. Why are so many people reluctant to say that Black Lives Matter? And then as I talked with some of the protesters, a number of them didn't want to take it down. Others didn't seem to care. Many others did want it down. And then why are there these big trucks circling the courthouse, revving their engines to protest the protest? So these were kind of my research questions as I approached the podcast.
You know, thinking about it, it's interesting. You mentioned a divided country, a divided state, a divided county. The statue itself, as mentioned in the introduction, is in a way divided with the Confederate belt buckle and Union hat.
That's right. And that's part of the story of the podcast. It's a biography of that statue, right? That is frankly really quite bizarre, with this divided identity. And I try to figure out how it got that way. On another level, it's really about the county itself, right? About Jessamine County, Kentucky, that the social worlds that built that statue, the brutality of slavery, the inspiration of emancipation, the grieving of dead Civil War soldiers. And of course, ultimately, it's about Jessamine County right now. That summer of 2020 was kind of wild. There was COVID, there was religion, as a group of interracial ministers tried to move it to a local cemetery. There was contentious politics. I mean, what could possibly go wrong as my county tries to figure out what to do with this thing?
Well, the podcast is rich with the voices of people in Nicholasville and Jessamine County. Are defenders of the statue also represented?
Yeah, they are. In fact, one Monday morning, as I was beginning coverage, I got a call from a friend who had just driven by the statue and had seen a man guarding it with a gun. Now, Tom, don't tell my bosses at the university, but I cut my own class and jumped into my minivan and interviewed the guy. That's how episode two begins. And I go on and talk with lots of defenders of the statue. And really, that's how the podcast grew and grew, right? With all of these living people, my neighbors that I got to know, I'm a historian, so I'm used to researching dead people, but the story just grew and grew as the rich social networks of this county came to life for me.
As an educator, what did you learn along the way, especially where it concerns the divisive nature of the times we're in now?
I came to appreciate, you know, just how polarized things are right now. I mean, I document that pretty clearly in the podcast as things unfolded between 2020 and 2024. But as we all know now, it might even be worse now in 2025. Last week, I actually bought an advertisement on social media to try to spread the word about Rebel on Main. Probably shouldn't have, but I did. And the comments are kind of insane. Toxic comments. I'm pulling one up right now, and it reads like this. "Leave the statues alone, you worthless bunch of spineless, backstabbing, anti-American liberals." So the depth and the intensity of the emotion is really striking, I think. And it offers a glimpse into the, I mean, we find ourselves in a deeply polarized nation, and not just on how we remember the Civil War, but on a whole set of other issues too, ranging from policing to gender and sexuality, COVID policy. To be honest, I had hoped that a long-form, reasoned, personal narrative that tried to practice empathy might ratchet down the polarization, but the early returns aren't very good. 7 days after I put that post up, and about 500 mean and toxic comments later, I'm kind of heartbroken at the state of our civil discourse, our uncivil discourse. You know, one thing I should say, though, is that it's not new here. Jessamine County was a deeply divided county way back in the 1860s. The county supplied equal numbers of troops to both sides, to the Union and the Confederacy. I mean, neighbors weren't just mad at each other. They were killing each other. So Black Lives Matter versus Blue Lives Matter hasn't been fun to see and experience. But, I mean, and I don't want to minimize our current moment, but it's been a whole lot worse.
Where can our listeners go to find the podcast?
Anywhere where you listen to podcasts, Apple Podcasts, Spotify. If you go to my website, rebelonmain.com, you can listen there and also see a lot of photographs of the protests and of the statue of Pastor Moses and all of the other, you know, fascinating characters that are on Rebel on Main.
All right. That's Asbury University history professor and creator of the podcast series Rebel on Main, David Swartz. Thanks so much, David.
Thanks so much, Tom.
Coming up after the break, two inductees into the Kentucky Writers Hall of Fame, Crystal Wilkinson and Frank X. Walker, and all about the Mythos experience based on the art of John Tuska, about to arrive in a classroom at Paul Lawrence Dunbar High School.
The Mythos experience is basically 19 of his works and words and titles all by him about self-reflection.
I'm Tom Martin, and you're listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.
WEKU has teamed up with NPR and stations in Kentucky, Tennessee, and West Virginia to form the Appalachian and Mid-South Newsroom. This special collaboration will provide news about the issues that matter the most in our communities. Listen for stories from the Appalachian and Mid-South Newsroom on NPR at WEKU. The WEKU app is redesigned and totally updated. We've made it easier to play the live streams of WEKU and WEKU Classical. You can also find WEKU podcasts and NPR podcasts all in one place. There's more information on what's playing on WEKU Classical. The updated WEKU app is available in the Apple App Store and on Google Play.
You're listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU. I'm Tom Martin. We have a lot of really good writers here in Kentucky, so many that there's a Kentucky Writers Hall of Fame to honor them. And as we'll hear from Tom Eblin, the latest to be named to this lineup of literary legends will be honored at a ceremony March 10th at the Kentucky Theater in Lexington.
All four living inductees plan to be there. Playwright Naomi Wallace, a Louisville native who now lives in England, two founding members of the Appalachian Poets, Frank X. Walker and Crystal Wilkinson, and Appalachian historian Ron Eller. Also inducted will be the late David Dick, a former CBS News correspondent, who in retirement wrote 11 books plus three more with his wife Lolly Dick, mostly about their shared love for Kentucky. Two of those inductees are with us today. Frank X. Walker and Crystal Wilkinson are both professors of creative writing at the University of Kentucky and former Kentucky Poets Laureate. Walker, who was born and raised in Danville, recently published his 14th book, Load In Nine Times, a moving collection of historical poetry based on the lives of black Kentuckians during the Civil War era. Wilkinson, a Casey County native, last year published her 5th book, Pray Song for the Kitchen Ghost, Stories and Recipes from 5 Generations of Black Country Cooks. It became a national bestseller and made several lists of the best books of 2024. Crystal and Frank, welcome to Eastern Standard.
Thanks for having us.
Yes, great to be here.
Well, first of all, what does it mean to each of you to be added to the Hall of Fame?
Well, anyone who knows me knows that everything makes me cry. So this was this was another thing, and I don't mean that lightly. I mean, I'm deeply moved, especially by things relating to home. And I think having lived in Kentucky all my life and seen so many of our great writers become Poets Laureate, you know, that was a milestone for me and also made me cry because I can remember, you know, standing in line and Frank elbowing me saying, go up and talk to him. And both Wendell Berry and Mr. Steele being at the table in Frankfurt, I think at the book fair, and Frank elbowing me and say, go on. and so to go from those beginning moments to being Poet Laureate was sort of a penultimate. And then, of course, this too, having known so many writers that have been named, many of them my heroes and sheroes that have been named to the Hall of Fame, is really special.
Mm-hmm. And what about you, Frank?
Yeah, I mean, I'm just enjoying all of Crystal's responses, but it's, you know, I didn't cry when I heard about it, but I'm still trying to process. It's been kind of a surreal experience for me because on one hand, it feels like I just started writing and how is this possible? And then on the other hand, it's like, wow, I've been writing that long. I'm over now. So I'm somewhere between just trying to process what it means time-wise. But, you know, all that aside, you know, it feels extra special because of this particular class. You know, I knew David Dick and I know Ron Eller and then my sister Crystal. To be able to share this moment with her is just makes it even more special. So it's... Mm-hmm. You know, maybe I'll cry that evening. I don't know.
Oh, we'll see. You mentioned that, you know, your sister, you all have kind of really come up in Kentucky literature together in a lot of ways. And both of your writing so much centers on the black experience in Kentucky, and which is often not very well known outside of the state and sometimes not within the state. How did you both come to focus on that?
Well, I always find this story of me and Frank very interesting because we never knew each other, you know, through grade school or high school, even though we're just a year. He's a year older, like siblings do. I have to rub that in every chance I get. But but we didn't know one another during those years. So it was during both of our formative years as writers that we got to know each other. And that's when we found out that we grew up in towns adjacent to each other and had sort of some mirroring experiences that even our first cousins had married each other and all of those kinds of things. So that, as Frank said, has made it even more special because I think our experiences, even though I was very, very country and Frank was in town, you know, from where I'm from, living in Danville.
Danville's
in town.
A big city.
Huh? Yeah. Our experience, I think, mirrored one another as shy, bookish kids who were all about writing and reading and being able to advance in that way. And like I said, it wasn't until years and years later through the Appalachian Poets that we actually met. But I think our experiences as beginning writers matched up, even the sense of, I think we were both journalists at one point in our lives.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, I was going to say, yes, all of that, you know, and I love that synchronicity. And at the same time, I think about, I mean, to answer the question, I don't think I was thinking about my writing being specifically about a Black story or Black families. I was just writing about my family and what I knew in the way that I could. And I think, but what really pushed me into really focusing on Kentucky stories and Black Kentucky stories was traveling outside of Kentucky and meeting people who were shocked that there were Black people in Kentucky.
Mm-hmm.
And I was just stunned by the idea that somebody on a college campus, you know, close to a degree, would ask me that question. The question was, are there other Black people in Kentucky? And I, you know, my mouth just fell open. and I pretended to count them in that moment. And this person was waiting for me to get to the final number. But it just seemed so surreal to me. And it really, I think, kind of helped focus my work a little bit because I recognized that that person was not an anomaly, that there were a lot of other people who, because of mass media's representation of Kentucky and the region, never saw people of color. I felt like I had a responsibility to tell my people's stories or help tell it. And I think I'm still there. I mean, there's still so many more stories to be told and ways to tell them. That's the part that makes me feel like a teenager just starting. You know, I used to always say that when I grow up, I'm going to be a filmmaker.
Yeah.
And make the same stories, you know?
Yeah. What is it, you know, about Kentucky you think that kind of really grows so many great writers?
I think one of the things is the land and the spirit of land itself and the people. I mean, I've always been, I didn't know how important they were, but I've always been an eavesdropper and a storyteller, like observing people in church and observing my family and all of the mannerisms and thinking, not knowing that that was perhaps unique to other people, and had that sort of experience like Frank had of like the aha moment of like, oh, this is what I'm going to do. I'm going to hold my people, these particular people and their complexity and their nuance up to the light for others to see. Mm-hmm. so that we're not invisible. And I think that adjacent to that, what makes writers blossom and grow in Kentucky is the generosity of other writers.
Absolutely.
You know, I wasn't aware of it at the time when I was standing in that line and Frank was elbowing me, like going up there. And it was, like I said, it was Wendell Berry, it was Georgetta Lyon, it was all of those people. And I didn't realize at the time how accessible they were.
Yeah.
Like these were famous writers from Kentucky that would come up and give you a nod. Like I remember almost fainting when I read somewhere one time and Wendell walked up and remembered lines from the story I read and said, you know, that was, I like that. You know, that was good.
Wow,
and me just being like, oh. But I think that kind of generosity from other writers, we've never had that sort of competitive spirit that I hear from my colleagues from other states. There's always a writer, be they famous or burgeoning in Kentucky, that are willing to give you a hand up and to comment on your work and to refer a publisher to you or read a poem or whatever it takes. So I think that that's been a big part of it too.
Yeah.
For sure. You know, especially, or giving you your first book deal. You know, I think that if not for Gurney Norman and his wife, Naoka, Afrolatcha would not have ever existed. And,
mm-hmm.
and I would have been pushed into that world of seeing my work in print and learning to love that feeling and make it to this point, quote unquote career.
When I talked to you last, you each had a long list of projects you were hoping to get to. What are you writing now?
I'm working on a memoir about my mother and Black women and mental illness, and particularly, again, my mother. It's a memoir, and it's called Heartsick, and will be out with Crown Publishing in 2026.
Oh, good. What about you, Frank?
She's definitely closer to finish than I am. I'm working on two things, a set of short stories inspired by Gurney Norman's Kinfolk and another collection of historical poems that deal with 100 years of racism in America, but through the lenses of leisure and golf, that, you know, kind of focuses on amateur black golf in the United States. Not so much in Kentucky, because there wasn't much in Kentucky, but everywhere else, especially in the South, it was happening, and happening in and around the Civil Rights era, and, you know, reaching all the way back to the end of the 1800s. You know, the story goes back way before Tiger Woods. A lot of people only think of Tiger as the burgeoning of black golf, but, you know, I think the 100 years I'm focusing on actually ends with Tiger Woods going pro. You know, so that 100 years prior to Tiger Woods gave birth to a whole era of activity in America that really has been a fascinating story to research and to write about.
That's great. I look forward to reading both of those. With us today has been Crystal Wilkinson and Frank X. Walker, two of the five latest inductees into the Kentucky Writers Hall of Fame. Come see them accept their awards on March 10th at 7 p.m. at the Kentucky Theater in downtown Lexington. The ceremony is free and open to the public. No tickets required. Thanks for being with us, Frank and Crystal.
Thank you.
Reporting for Eastern Standard, this is Tom Eblin with the Carnegie Center for Literacy and Learning.
One chance, no plans, wish I had a clone. Fast cars, gold bars, living in the zone. Late nights, bright lights, never be alone. Multiple paths, one wish, living like a stone. One life is not enough, need another turn. One life is not enough, so much left to learn. One life is not enough, so much left to earn. One life is not enough, feel the fire burn.
Lexington sculptor John Tusca had a sign on his studio wall, Non basta una vita, Italian for one life is not enough. You can say that again. John Tusca died in 1998 at the age of 67, and now his observation about the limits of time is being observed in a way that carries his life into that of another, his son, Seth. Seth Tusca is with us here in the studio, along with Jamie Preptee. Jamie teaches art at Paul Lawrence Dunbar High School here in Lexington, and they're here to tell us about a Tusca-based art education program that's about to get underway at Dunbar. Welcome to Eastern Standard.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So, Seth, you've done quite a lot to secure your father's legacy. You created a 60-piece traveling exhibition, turning your childhood home into a museum of your father's work, launching a studio, gallery, and reproductions business to support the museum. And there's a documentary that aired on KET, and now this educational program, the Mythos Experience. What is that?
Well, Tom, thank you. Dad, I'll call him Dad, I'll call him Tusca, I'll call him Dracula. He asked me to share his life as an educator. And people always ask me, am I an artist? And I always tell them, if you wanted to be with him, you worked with him. And I did my entire life. So I understand the process and techniques. But what the one thing that he reinforced to me was, unless you're going to be an artist for life, find the art that makes you a better you while you live your art that pays the bills. So fast forward now, and now that I've got five grandkids and I'm focusing on young people and trying to help young people to the value of the arts. And the Mythos Experience is taking Dad's life, that capsule of a 40-year relationship with his muse, both dying very early, 67 and 65, but to take that opportunity to spend time with him in life lessons. And the Mythos Experience is basically 19 of his works and words and titles all by him about self-reflection. And what he's hoping to do is to empower you to think about yourself as you're viewing the art to make you a better person.
I want to get into the program in just a second, but also want to ask you, I read a column that Tom Eblin did a few years ago.
Okay.
And in it, you mentioned that as a sculptor, your father was trying to create the idea that you're looking at what's going to happen next, where emotion is going. Okay. Of course, this is radio, so
sure.
Can you describe for us what that looks like?
The comment when that was brought to me was, your father's art is more abstract than realistic. Well, he wasn't trying to be realistic. He was trying to, as an educator, trying to create in his work that movement of his work into thinking about where it goes next, so the motion of it.
So, Jamie, what figured into your decision to bring this experience to your students at Dunbar?
Well, I liked what it encompassed. There's a huge component that supports mental and emotional well-being. It creates a space for students to process emotions and encourages dialogue about personal and collective experiences. It also enhances critical thinking and creativity. It challenges students to think about art on a deeper level and how it reflects the human condition and connects all of us. It builds empathy and connection, and it does align with educational goals across multiple disciplines, not only the visual arts, but literature, history, and social emotional learning.
Now, as I understand it, at the beginning of the class, each student is given a notebook. And if you would tell us about that, what's in it and what will you encourage them to put in it?
The notebook is amazing. It has Tuska's art in color on one page, and then a sheet that the students can write their reflections. There's prompts to help them analyze their emotions and how they feel about the art, and just their personal connections to the artwork.
And you mentioned a second ago that this helps a student process emotions. Could you give us an example of the experience of processing emotions through art?
I like to use the act of sculpting raw clay. First, you have art, which is the sculptor who takes an unshaped mass of clay and molds it into a form. Each movement of the hand brings structure and meaning, turning something formless into an expression of thought, emotion, or experience. The mindfulness piece comes when the sculpting demands the artist's full attention to the present moment. It's a meditative process where the student lets go of all distractions and becomes fully immersed in the act of creation. And the human condition component is just like clay that is shaped and reshaped. So are we by our experiences, struggles, and triumphs.
As you were describing that, I was thinking about the pleasure of holding clay in your hands and molding clay, which is wonderful. But it's about more than that tactile experience and about the material itself, right?
It is. It's about the essence of the material and becoming one with the material to create something.
What sort of introspection do you hope to inspire in students through Tuska's work?
I hope to cultivate empathy, not only for themselves, but for others. By engaging with Tuska's work, students can understand how their experiences connect with the broader human condition, recognizing that we all share similar struggles and triumphs.
And what sorts of themes do you anticipate they're going to explore?
The themes that I hope that they explore are identity and self-discovery, uncovering layers of their identity shaped by experiences, values, and dreams. I hope they explore connection and empathy, reflecting on how their own stories intertwine with others. I hope they explore transformation and growth. I hope they, not only the external pressures that force them to grow, but eternal growth that they choose to make.
Well, Seth, when you put this program together, I wonder if you were thinking about what you hope this work will encourage students to think about their world.
The intent of this was twofold. First of all, it's mythos means story. So this is just a one man story. Mm-hmm. The opportunity here is for you to spend time with him and walk through his life with him, hoping that there's something that's going to trigger something new about you, your emotions, your feelings, the questions were piling. We're asking basically three questions. Where have you been? Where am I now? Where am I going? And then to relate that to here in this capsule of this life in these pieces. The experience is set up in the round. And the idea is 19 of these wall-hanging works are on easels surrounded by a sculpture of a torso that is supposed to represent you. You're the energy source. It's called energy source, and you're the middle of this. And you're coming to class with your sketchbook to take notes and doodle and write and whatever compels you to, during this experience, prompted by these questions that we're pondering.
Okay, and it gets underway on March 10th. Have students shown interest?
Yes, they're always interested in self-exploration. And I think this encompasses it with the questions that are asked, where have I been, where am I now, and where am I going? I feel like whether a student is genuinely interested in the subject of art or not, those are questions that we all ponder and ask, especially when we're young.
How long will it go on?
We are going to have two classes where they're exploring the art, and then they are going to be creating artwork based on Tuska's art and empathy.
And then once it's done, do you have a way that you can gauge how it influenced them?
First of all, we'll have classroom discussions. So it's how involved the students are in the discussions, and that will be a gauge. It's also the observation of how many students are participating and if there's a change in their body language or their interactions with students or adults while they're exploring this new art. And then there will be guided sharing. We'll be asking them questions to prompt deep thinking. And then the art that's created will also be a reflection of the program.
And will we get to see some of their work?
Yes. We've got big plans for the work. We're going to do one bead, one story. And so the students will be creating a bead. And then we are going to create an art installation that will hopefully be in a very public place downtown Lexington.
Oh, great. And is this the first iteration of this class, Seth? Are you talking to other schools?
Oh, trust me. This actually started with Fayette County 2 years ago because I presented this to teachers at their pre-kickoff. And Jamie just happened to be one, and we ran into each other a few months ago, which kind of kicked this. Mythos is a pop-up experience. It's a print show, so I'm not worried about the original art. And it's something, can you give me a space and 20 easels, and we're good to go. And then you can pop it up and keep as many as long as you want. It's also got choreographed music that goes with it as well.
So if a non-school organization out there wanted to do this, they could do this.
What I would tell you is if you or your group are ever into reflection, this is a perfect thing to spend a little time with.
Well, Jamie Prepty and Seth Tuska, thank you so much for coming in and talking with us.
Thank you.
Absolutely, thank you so much.
Thanks for joining us. Eastern Standard is produced at the studios of Dynamics Productions. Mike Savage, executive producer. Neil Kesterson, sound designer and technical director. Ella Fitzgeraldine, studio dog. We're online at eswku.org, where you can check out our archive, our series, our partners, and sign up for our newsletter. And you can find Eastern Standard on weku.org, on the WEKU app, and podcast versions on Apple, Spotify, and the NPR app. Want to call something to our attention or suggest a topic? Our email is es@eku.edu. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.